When Seagoy raised the islands of the world from the sea in the beginning of time, the dragons were the firstborn of the land and the wind blowing over the land. So the song of the creation tells. But her song told also that then, in the beginning, dragon and human were all one. They were all one people, one race, winged and speaking the true language. They were beautiful and strong and wise and free. But in time, nothing can be without becoming. So among the dragon people, some became more and more in love with flight and wildness, and would have less and less to do with the works of making, or with study and learning, or with houses and cities. They wanted only to fly farther and farther, hunting and eating their kill, ignorant and uncaring, seeking more freedom and more. Others of the dragon people came to care little for flight, but gathered up treasure, wealth, things made, things learned. They built houses, strongholds to keep their treasures in, so they could pass all they gained to their children, ever seeking more increase and more. And they came to fear the wild ones, who might come flying and destroy all their dear hoard, burn it up in a blast of flame out of mere carelessness and ferocity. The wild ones feared nothing. They learned nothing. Because they were ignorant and fearless, they could not save themselves when the flightless ones trapped them as animals and killed them. But other wild ones would come flying and set the beautiful houses afire and destroy and kill. Those that were strongest, wild or wise, were those who killed each other first. Those who were most afraid, they hid from the fighting, and when there was no more hiding, they ran from it. They used their skills of making and made boats and sailed east, away from the western isles, where the great winged ones made war among the ruined towers. So those who had been both dragon and human changed, becoming two peoples. The dragons, always fewer and wilder, scattered by their endless, mindless greed and anger in the far islands of the western reach. And the human folk, always more numerous in their rich towns and cities, filling up the inner isles and all the south and east. But among them, there were some who saved the learning of the dragons, the true language of the making, and these are now the wizards. But also, the song said, there are those among us who know they once were dragons, and among the dragons there are some who know their kinship with us. And these say that when the one people were becoming two, some of them, still both human and dragon, still winged, went not east but west, on over the open sea, till they came to the other side of the world. There they live in peace, great winged beings, both wild and wise, with human mind and dragon heart. And so she sang, farther west than west, beyond the land, my people are dancing on the other wind. So, that was a story told in the song of the woman of Kimei, and it ended with those words. Then Ogeon said to her, when I first saw you, I saw your true being. This woman who sits across the hearth from me is no more than the dress she wears. But she shook her head and laughed, and all she would say was, if only it were that simple. So then, after a while, Ogeon came back to Rey Albi. And when he told me the story, he said to me, ever since that day, I have wondered if anyone, man or dragon, has been farther west than west, and who we are, and where our wholeness lies. Are you getting hungry, Theru? There's a good sitting place, it looks like, up there where the road turns. Maybe from there we'll be able to see Gaunt Port, away down at the foot of the mountain. It's a big city, even bigger than Valnath. We'll sit down when we get to the turn and rest a bit. From the high corner of the road, they could indeed look down the vast slopes of forest and rocky meadow to the town on its bay, and see the crags that guarded the entrance to the bay, and the boats on the dark water like wood chips or water beetles. Far ahead on their road, and still somewhat above it, a cliff jutted out from the mountainside, the Overfell, on which was the village of Rey Albi, the Falcon's Nest. Theru made no complaints, But when, presently, Gohar said, "Well, shall we go on?" the child, sitting there between the road and the gulfs of sky and sea, shook her head. The sun was warm, and they had walked a long way since their breakfast in the dell. Gohar brought out their water bottle, and they drank again. Then she brought out a bag of raisins and walnuts and gave it to the child. "We're in sight of where we're going," she said, "and I'd like to be there before dark if we can. I'm anxious to see Ojiyan. You'll be very tired, but we won't walk fast. And we'll be there safe and warm tonight. Keep the bag. Tuck it in your belt. Raisins make your legs strong. Would you like a staff, like a wizard, to help you walk?" Daru munched and nodded. Gohar took out her knife and cut a strong shoot of hazel for the child, and then, seeing an alder fallen above the road, broke off a branch of it and trimmed it to make herself a stout, light stick. They set off again, and the child trudged along, beguiled by raisins. Gohar sang to amuse them both, love songs and shepherd songs and ballads she had learned in the Middle Valley. But all at once her voice hushed in the middle of a tune. She stopped, putting out her hand in a warning gesture. The four men ahead of them on the road had seen her. There was no use trying to hide in the woods till they went on or went by. "Travelers," she said quietly to Theru, and walked on. She took a good grip on her alder stick. What Lark had said about gangs and thieves was not just the complaint each generation makes that things aren't what they used to be and the world's going to the dogs. In the last several years, there had been a loss of peace and trust in the towns and countrysides of Gaunt. Young men behaved like strangers among their own people, abusing hospitality, stealing, selling what they stole. Beggary was common where it had been rare, and the unsatisfied beggar threatened violence. Women did not like to go alone in the streets and roads, nor did they like that loss of freedom. Some of the young women ran off to join the gangs of thieves and poachers. Often, they came home within the year, sullen, bruised, and pregnant. And among village sorcerers and witches, there was rumor of matters of their profession going amiss. Charms that had always cured did not cure. Spells of finding found nothing, or the wrong thing. Love potions drove men into frenzies, not of desire, but of murderous jealousy. And worse than this, they said, people who knew nothing of the art of magic, the laws and limits of it, and the dangers of breaking them, were calling themselves people of power, promising wonders of wealth and health to their followers, promising even immortality. Ivy, the witch of Goha's village, had spoken darkly of this weakening of magic, and so had Beach, the sorcerer of Valmouth. He was a shrewd and modest man who had come to help Ivy do what little could be done to lessen the pain and scarring of Theru's burns. He had said to Gohar, "I think a time in which such things as this occur must be a time of ruining, the end of an age. How many hundred years since there was a king in Havner? It can't go on so. We must turn to the center again or be lost. Island against island, man against man, father against child." He had glanced at her somewhat timidly, yet with his clear, shrewd look. "The ring of Aerith Akbi is restored to the tower in Havner," he said. "I know who brought it there. That was the sign, surely. That was the sign of the new age to come. But we haven't acted on it. We have no king. We have no center. We must find our heart, our strength. Maybe the archmage will act at last." And he added with confidence, "After all, he is from Gaunt." But no word of any deed of the archmage or any heir to the throne in Havner had come, and things went badly on. So it was with fear and a grim anger that Gohar saw the four men on the road before her step two to each side so that she and the child would have to pass between them. As they went walking steadily forward, Theru kept very close beside her, holding her head bent down, but she did not take her hand. One of the men, a big-chested fellow with coarse black hairs on his upper lip drooping over his mouth, began to speak, grinning a little. Hey there, he said. But Gohas spoke at the same time and louder. Out of my way, she said, raising her alder stick as if it were a wizard's staff. I have business with Ogeon. She strode between the men and straight on, Theru trotting beside her. The men, mistaking effrontery for witchery, stood still. Ogeon's name perhaps still held power. Or perhaps there was a power in Goha, or in the child. For when the two had gone by, one of the men said, Did you see that? And spat, and made the sign to avert evil. Witch and her monster brat, another said. Let him go. Another, a man in a leather cap and jerkin, stood staring for a moment while the others slouched on their way. His face looked sick and stricken. Yet he seemed to be turning to follow the woman and child when the hairy-lipped man called to him, Come on, Handy! And he obeyed. Out of sight, around the turn of the road, Goha had picked up Theru and hurried on with her until she had to set her down and stand gasping. The child asked no questions and made no delays. As soon as Goha could go on again, the child walked as fast as she could beside her, holding her hand. You're red, she said, like fire. She spoke seldom and not clearly, her voice being very hoarse. But Goha could understand her. I'm angry, Goha said with a kind of laugh. When I'm angry, I turn red. Like you people, you red people, you barbarians of the western lands. Look, there's a town there ahead. That'll be Oak Springs. It's the only village on this road. We'll stop there and rest a little. Maybe we can get some milk. And then, if we can go on, if you think you can walk on up to the Falcon's Nest, we'll be there by nightfall, I hope. The child nodded. She opened her bag of raisins and walnuts and ate a few. They trudged on. The sun had long set when they came through the village and to Ogeon's house on the clifftop. The first stars glimmered above a dark mass of clouds in the west over the high horizon of the sea. The sea wind blew, bowing short grasses. A goat bleated in the pastures behind the low, small house. The one window shone dim yellow. Goha stood her stick and Theru's against the wall by the door and held the child's hand and knocked once. There was no answer. She pushed the door open. The fire on the hearth was out, cinders and gray ashes, but an oil lamp on the table made a tiny seed of light, and from his mattress on the floor in the far corner of the room, Ogeon said, Come in, Tenar. Ogeon. She bedded down the child on the cot in the western alcove. She built up the fire. She went and sat down beside Ogeon's pallet, cross-legged on the floor. No one looking after you. I sent them off, he whispered. His face was as dark and hard as ever, but his hair was thin and white, and the dim lamp made no spark of light in his eyes. You could have died alone, she said, fierce. Help me do that, the old man said. Not yet, she pleaded, stooping, laying her forehead on his hand. Not tonight, he agreed. Tomorrow. He lifted his hand to stroke her hair once, having that much strength. She sat up again. The fire had caught. Its light played on the walls and low ceiling and sent shadows to thicken in the corners of the long room. If Ged would come, the old man murmured. Have you sent to him? Lost, Ogeon said. He's lost. A cloud. A mist over the lands. He went into the west, carrying the branch of the rowan tree. Into the dark mist. I've lost my hawk. No, 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 she whispered. He'll come back. They were silent. The fire's warmth began to penetrate them both, letting Ogeon relax and drift in and out of sleep, letting Tenar find rest pleasant after the long day afoot. She rubbed her feet and her aching shoulders. She had carried Theru part of the last long climb, for the child had begun to gasp with weariness as she tried to keep up. Tenar got up, heated water, and washed the dust of the road from her. She heated milk and ate bread she found in Ogeon's larder and came back to sit by him. While he slept, she sat thinking, watching his face and the firelight and the shadows. She thought how a girl had sat silent, thinking, in the night, a long time ago and far away. A girl in a windowless room, brought up to know herself only as the one who had been eaten, priestess and servant of the powers of the darkness of the earth. And there had been a woman who would sit up in the peaceful silence of a farmhouse when husband and children slept, to think, to be alone an hour. And there was the widow who had carried a burned child here, who sat by the side of the dying, who waited for a man to return. Like all women, any woman, doing what women do. But it was not by the names of the servant or the wife or the widow that Ogeon had called her, nor had Ged in the darkness of the tombs, nor, longer ago, farther away than all, had her mother, the mother she remembered only as the warmth and lion color of firelight, the mother who had given her her name. "I am Tenar," she whispered. The fire, catching a dry branch of pine, leaped up in a bright yellow tongue of flame. Ogeon's breathing became troubled, and he struggled for air. She helped him as she could till he found some ease. They both slept for a while, she drowsing by his dazed and drifting silence, broken by strange words. Once in the deep night he said aloud, as if meeting a friend in the road, "Are you here, then? Have you seen him?" And again, when Tenar roused herself to build up the fire, he began to speak. But this time it seemed he spoke to someone in his memory of years long gone, for he said clearly, as a child might, "I tried to help her, but the roof of the house fell down. It fell on them. It was the earthquake." Tenar listened. She, too, had seen earthquake. "I tried to help," said the boy in the old man's voice in pain. Then the gasping struggle to breathe began again. At first light, Tenar was wakened by a sound she thought at first was the sea. It was a great rushing of wings. A flock of birds was flying over, low, so many that their wings stormed, and the window was darkened by their quick shadows. It seemed they circled the house once, and then were gone. They made no call or cry, and she did not know what birds they were. People came that morning from the village of Realbi, which Ogeon's house stood apart from to the north. A goat girl came, and a woman for the milk of Ogeon's goats, and others to ask what they might do for him. Moss, the village witch, fingered the alder stick and the hazel switch by the door and peered in, hopefully, but not even she ventured to come in, and Ogeon growled from his pallet, "Send him away! Send them all away!" He seemed stronger and more comfortable. When little Theru woke, he spoke to her in the dry, kind, quiet way Tenar remembered. The child went out to play in the sun, and he said to Tenar, "What is the name you call her?" He knew the true language of the making, but he had never learned any Kargish at all. "Theru means burning, the flaming of fire," she said. "Ah, ah," he said, and his eyes gleamed, and he frowned. He seemed to grope for words for a moment. "That one," he said, "that one, they will fear her." "They fear her now," Tenar said bitterly. The mage shook his head. "Teach her, Tenar," he whispered. "Teach her all. Not Roke. They are afraid. Why did I let you go? Why did you go? To bring her here? Too late?" "Be still, be still," she told him tenderly, for he struggled with words and breath and could find neither. He shook his head and gasped, "Teach her," and lay still. He would not eat and only drank a little water. In the middle of the day he slept. Waking in the late afternoon, he said, "Now, daughter," and sat up. Tenar took his hand, smiling at him. "Help me get up." "No, no." "Yes," he said. "Outside. I can't die indoors." "Where would you go?"
"Anywhere.
But if I could, the forest path," he said. the beach above the meadow. When she saw he was able to get up and determined to get outdoors, she helped him. Together they got to the door, where he stopped and looked around the one room of his house. In the dark corner to the right of the doorway, his tall staff leaned against the wall, shining a little. Tenar reached out to give it to him, but he shook his head. "No," he said, "not that." He looked around again as if for something missing, forgotten. "Come on," he said at last.